Being the Worst, Episode 4, recorded live, Tuesday, August 28th, 2012. From beingtheworst.com, it's the Being the Worst podcast, audio apprenticeships for the aspiring software craftsman, with your hosts, Carrie Street and Renat Abdulin. In this episode, Carrie and Renat review questions about designing command and event messages and then introduce the new topic of event sourcing. And now, here are Carrie and Renat. Hello, and welcome back to the Being the Worst podcast. This is Carrie. How are you doing, Renat?
I'm doing pretty good, thanks. What about you today?
I'm doing well. This is our first episode that we get to record where it's the morning for me, so I feel like I have a little bit more energy today. That could be a good or a bad thing for you, but thanks for doing this late your time after your workday, so I appreciate it. So today we're getting into the event sourcing basics, but before we do that, we're going to, as we mentioned last time, get into the homework stuff. And so episode 3 about commanding your words, the assignment was to get into, you know, documenting the vocabulary of the basic factory example that there's a diagram in the code there where it lays out basically a manager issuing commands to a factory worker and their response to those commands and very basic car factory example. And so if you look at my homework, I took a stab at doing the vocabulary of the factory, documenting some of the reports, and trying to take a stab at some of the command and event design. And I wrote down some questions I had for the homework. Renat, are you ready for those?
Yes, sure, definitely. And one thing I just want to highlight before we dive in there. So in essence, like this homework assignment, for you or for somebody else listening to the podcast, it might have seen as an exercise in creative writing. Actually, it's extremely important because like as in the previous podcast, we highlighted the importance of words. And words, they come together to form coherent model, to form coherent picture. And when these words are expressed with usual human vocabulary, these are expressed as human-readable text, as paragraphs, as descriptions that humans can understand. When this meaning is expressed with messages and also aggregate behaviors which work operate with these messages, it's how computers will understand this meaning and how they will carry out the orders. And by pushing additional effort into writing out these human-readable messages, and both in the written form and in the code form, and by keeping these two forms close together, we will ensure that our programs will stay close to the reality, and that if reality changes, it will be extremely easy to change the programs as well. Because like the words, they, if they're captured correctly, they don't really change. For example, car. The car will stay always the car. Like the meaning might change slightly, the colors of the cars might change, but the term of the car hasn't changed since Henry Ford invented his Model T, which was only in the black color. Mm-hmm. And so by creating and crafting actually our vocabulary, we will simply, and by putting additional effort into making that vocabulary ubiquitous and descriptive, we'll make sure that our domain model that is being captured with this vocabulary will stay real and close to reality, and that the code, which is representation of the domain model, it will be easy to evolve. In essence, like although this is just our fourth episodes, we're going quite deep into the basics and the most important things of the domain-driven design. And in essence, if you can capture that and be able to operate with that and understand the importance of that, then you're aiming for the position of domain developers. And in any enterprise, domain developers are among the most expensive and highly paid developers because they can both code and they can capture the essence of the business, the core business concepts, using the simple, plain language. Okay, that was a sidestep from just to highlight once again the real importance of these exercises that might seem like a creative writing. but they're like they're essential.
No problem. I think almost anybody trying to speak to developers, programmers, anyone who likes to mess around with code to make something work probably needs to get a sales pitch in there once in a while to say, please try to think before you start coding just a little bit. We swear it's worth it, you know. So
yes.
So no problem. I actually enjoyed the exercise, and it made me think about the problem a little bit differently, and actually didn't finish all of it because I started to have questions and didn't want to duplicate a lot of the work. So you'll see that I started by doing the vocabulary, and then I just took basically the reports right off of your diagram to say, you know, the names of the reports. And then as I started writing the commands and events, the questions about how you actually design those started to come to mind. And I stopped because I felt like, you know, a lot of this is going to change. I don't feel like continuing. So my questions, even when I was doing this very simple factory example, it was very easy to start thinking of lots and lots of potential commands and events that would be required to actually create all the functionality that I would imagine. And so I could see right away why you might have wanted to invent that DSL tool to auto-generate your messages and events for you, because even just doing it in Word and in Markdown text, I was getting tired of, you know, typing out all of these parameters. And I'm like, I'd rather just be typing this in Visual Studio.
Yes.
Because it's going to be code anyway. This is no stop. So, but what general guideline do you use to determine, you know, which method calls should be the traditional direct calls to a class versus using a command message to decouple every call? Is the general goal in our approach to pretty much create a command and event for almost every possible piece of functionality that the requirements demand, or is there a fine line? Because if it's creating a command and event for everything, it just seemed like there was going to be lots and lots of them.
Okay, so in essence, there has to be a balance. The model has to be both descriptive, and it also will have to be applicable to the technology. So currently, like we're starting our domain model exercise, just from the side of the ubiquitous language, just from the side of the language. As we'll go deeper into the podcast, we'll go the process of domain modeling, starting from the textual model and down to the implementation. We'll go through this route multiple times.
Okay.
And while we'll do these iterations, we'll actually learn like how certain decisions, for example, at the vocabulary level, are carried out and how they work out in the code. And in essence, the idea is to start grasping the balance, grasping the limitations or maybe some side effects of the decisions that you make while thinking about the model in the words. Because although that we're saying like the domain model and the vocabulary are extremely important, like they're not the only important things. Because if you just start writing your domain language in poems, and they might look really beautiful and expressive in their language, but capturing that in the messages, when you have like probably one or two messages per poem line, you'll end up with too many messages, and that will be unyieldy and unpractical. So the balance between the amount of messages and the amount of meaning you put into these messages, it has to be balanced out.
Okay.
And the only way to learn this is just by doing these practical exercises.
Cool. Yeah, I think that's definitely helping me realize that balance is going to be needed, and that I need experience on where to find that balance. And so in an example, getting to your point you just made about, you know, how far do you go to make it poetic versus practical? And an example of that was when I started thinking about that, I started thinking about point of view and perspective and narrative voice. You know, I'm like, okay, I'm telling a story with this code, but from whose perspective and which point of view, you know? So it was very straightforward when I did things like, okay, a manager would say produce car. So I have a produce car message, and a worker mm-hmm. could reasonably say, you know, car produced, great. But then when I got into things like, but the worker could also respond, you know, I don't feel like it, or they don't respond at all. And I had, you know, in the current homework, I have a message called ignore manager with question marks mm-hmm. after it. And for things like that, where this unexpected behavior, my brain was scrambling on how would I create commands and events to represent those kinds of things, you know?
Okay, so we'll get to that.
Okay.
But short and quick tip is that not all the commands, not all behaviors that can be expressed in commands and events, not all behaviors that happen in the real world, they need to be captured.
Got it.
Because while we're capturing the main model, it's not an exact replica of the world. Because in the world, we have far too many details. We have far too many things. Like, for example, worker A might hate worker B, and they will never be able to work again. Like, they don't like working with each other. However, in the model, this might not be worth capturing. Because, like, when we capture something in the code, that requires our own effort. And we're interested in capturing only the things that are relevant for our code, for our problem at hand. And we consciously discard and ignore small things that don't matter.
So,
go ahead.
If we decided, for example, that all we care about in this domain is the car was either produced or it wasn't produced, I don't really care if he didn't feel like it or he chose to ignore the manager. It's just in this domain, I only care that it was either produced or not produced.
Yes. So in essence, like, for example, if we're talking about the factory, the reason why worker felt not like producing might be irrelevant. If our factory domain, if our book, essentially, if our narrative about the factory focuses on the psychological aspects, because maybe we're some company that creates psychological profiles for workers working on the factory. Mm. In that case, we might be interested in the psychological side effects.
I see.
So it's in essence, like our domain model, it's something similar to a book. We're writing a book, and as you know, you can't fit everything in the book. The book has to be coherent. It has to highlight the most important parts, and you have to ignore the rest. Otherwise, the reader will be just overloaded with things.
I see.
So in essence, like with the next episode, with the current episode on event sourcing, the idea would be to write a book, like a short narrative, about one day at a factory, basing on the words and the commands and events that you start encountering. So if you have any more questions, let's just get back to this and then switch forward.
No, I think that I do have a couple more questions unrelated to that, but they should be quick, I hope. But
sure.
But I think my takeaway was these are exactly the kinds of things that you're hoping come out of thinking through these things, and that's where we start to, when we get into the details of that, that will be more like the domain-driven design discussions, et cetera, right?
Yes, okay. Actually, the stuff, the homework that you were doing, it's already a domain, an exercise in domain modeling. You were capturing the ubiquitous language.
Okay.
And the book of Eric Evans and in the book of Von Bernon, ubiquitous language and vocabulary and the domain exercises and actually process of talking, of different like people talking about the commands, trying to use the command names in their language, to seeing what fits, what matches. It's actually the process of capturing domain language, domain model.
And as we learn that, those are the learning those things are going to help me resolve these questions I'm having, right?
Yes, of course.
Okay, cool. So the other things were more practical related. And so I was just curious, as I was writing down this vocabulary, when you actually do it in the real world, do you use any particular tool? Are you doing that in Microsoft Word? Or like, what do you actually do to document the vocabulary in those reports? Do you do something similar to what I did in the homework or totally different?
In essence, initially, I was writing these words in the text files just to see how it works, like essentially writing a dictionary. Then with a little bit of practice, like the process of writing a dictionary, it kind of became a little bit redundant. So when I'm writing, starting to sketch a domain model, I just write a description. I just write a simple text that silently, that hiddenly inside, uses these commands and events as part of the sentences. So I can, for example, if I were working on your domain model and I was writing a description, I would be writing like, okay, so we have a factory and this factory can create employees. And when employee is created, like he'll be able to work in the factory. And immediately, already in that sentence, I would snatch some inconsistency. Factory can create employee.
Mm-hmm.
Employee is created. Okay, if I go down to the factory and I start talking to the manager and like he'll look weird at me. So maybe you don't create an employee at a factory, but you can assign employee to a factory.
Mm-hmm.
And when employee is assigned to the factory, he can work on that.
I see.
And then, like, maybe there are some conditions that should be fulfilled when employee is assigned to the factory. when we're trying to assign employee to the factory. For example, in our specific factory, they might have a rule. One rule could be, because we have such a weird database system, employees with similar names are not accepted. Okay, so in essence, like when I'll be writing that domain model in text, or just thinking about it, or just communicating about it, like explaining this to other guys, I would say, okay, so you know, we have this factory, and you can assign new employees to the factory, and when you do that, well, you can assign an employee to a factory only if his name has not been recorded already at the factory, and if, say, his name is not Bender, because we all know that guys with the name Bender, they are trouble. And when employee is assigned to the factory, like, he can do work for that. For example, we have, like, at this factory, we have cargo bay. And each morning or, like, whatever time is convenient, car parts arrive at this, are transferred to this cargo bay from some supplier. However, like, these car parts can be transferred to the cargo bay only if there are two or more workers at the factory, or maybe if there is one or more worker at the factory, because there has to be somebody who can open the cargo bay doors. And when this cargo bay doors, when this stuff is transferred to the cargo bay, if it happens that if there are too many car parts, then the workers will start cursing. That's okay, and in our factory, since management is really interested in expanding their vocabulary, they happen to record this stuff as well, just for a future reference.
I see.
And so this is the quick story, like beginning of the story of the factory. However, like while I was telling it, I was actually using names of the commands and names of the events, like transfer car parts to the cargo bay,
mm-hmm.
or like assign employee to the factory, and then the event that employee was assigned. More than that, I was also mentioning behaviors like and conditions that should be fulfilled. Like, for example, I mentioned the condition that car parts can be transferred to the cargo bay only if there is one or more worker available at the factory. Or there was another business condition that if we're trying to assign worker with the name Bender to the factory, then it will actually fail because guys with the name Bender are not allowed at the facilities.
Right.
Okay. So back to your question. When I'm actually creating a domain model, so I'm doing two things in parallel. First, I'm writing a story. And while writing a story, just thinking about the story, I'm trying to think about it as a text with a highlighted in bold commands and events. However, practically, like, they're just highlighted for me, but whomever else reads this story, whomever else reads this text, they actually, I don't highlight this for them. They just see a plain text. And if this plain text makes sense to them, then, okay, we have some working domain model. If they start correcting some sentences, if they start correcting some words, then they're actually correcting names of the commands and events, or maybe they're correcting some business behaviors, which are hidden inside this text. Mm-hmm. In essence, although they're not developers, maybe they're just plain business people, but they're helping to shape the domain model. And since in my own vision, I have this like behaviors attached to this sentence, and since I have name of the command and event attached to this part and to this part, so in essence, as we shape the text, I see that actually how the code is shaped. So second part of the modeling exercise is actually writing a code that expresses the same things that the written text and also keep this code updated as the text, as the understanding changes. And obviously, so this text that we write to express our domain model and make it understandable by other guys who are not familiar with the development, it doesn't always need to be a plain text. Sometimes we can add, for example, a short hand-drawn diagram using Balsamiq or Visio or whatever else. Sometimes you can write a use case. You can mention, okay, this when this happens, this can happen. Or sometimes you can write specifications which explain the specific use case. In essence, what I'm trying to say is that you're not limited only to the text when you're explaining the model. It can be anything as long as the model is understood by other folks. As in your own mind, you can make the connection between this actual written in text domain model and the code that you are going to write. And as we will go through the process of both creating a textual domain model and also creating a domain model implemented in the code and maintaining the links between them, you'll get used to the process like of thinking of these two as parallel representations of the same thing and how to keep them in sync.
Right. So all of this is just really the foundation of learning how to communicate through text, diagrams, specifications, whatever tools you want to use to begin facilitating that two-way conversation between the people writing the code and the domain experts that understand what it needs to do.
Yes, and it's just a part of the process of finding core business concepts and capturing them first in the text. And for that text, since text is a representation of the domain model in our heads, and this representation can be extended to the code. And code is actually the thing that runs. And essentially, if you master that process, you would be able to look at maybe any complex market problem or go to the complex department with, I don't know, extremely involved and intricate paper workflows, and you'll be able first write them down on a sheet of paper and then implement them in a code in a rather straightforward way.
Cool. Well, thank you for that. I probably kept that going longer than you wanted me to, but I really thought it was important and I wanted to make sure I was heading in the right direction there, so I appreciate it. And I think it's time for us to get into the topic of today's episode, which is event sourcing basics. So before we get into the explanation of that, I'll just point the listeners to the GitHub code sample. We're going to be looking at the folder, the project name, E004 event sourcing basics. So if you want to follow along looking at the code later when you're back at your machine listening to this, that is what we are referring to today. So Renat, take it away.
Okay, so I actually already started explaining this basics of event sourcing in this sample while I was explaining the story of the factory.
Mm-hmm.
Actually, when I was talking about the text, when I was telling the stuff that can happen on the factory, I was actually having a code model already in mind, and I was actually explaining you the code model. So event sourcing, it's just an intricate way, maybe complex sounding way, of saying this simple thing. We're using the code to capture behaviors. And when these behaviors are executed, like when something happens in our domain model, we create events that say that something happened. And we persist these events as a history, in a journal, to say that this happened to the model, this stuff has happened to the model, this happened to the model. And we use these events. We learned how to persist messages in previous episodes, and we'll get back to that later, as a way to persist our histories, and in essence, as a way to persist our model. So in this sample, we'll try to implement factory. We will not focus right now at individual workers. We'll not go into the details of single car production. We're just focusing in the factory. And factory, in this case, it will be an object. This object, sometimes I might refer to it as an entity, but we'll get to the details semantics later. This factory implementation, it will have multiple methods. Methods will read something like this: assign employee to factory, transfer shipment to cargo bay, unload shipment from cargo bay, produce car. If you were listening before, you heard me saying these exact words about assigning employee to a factory, about transferring shipment to cargo bay, etc., etc.
Mm-hmm.
And just to avoid confusion, when we talk about methods, about command methods which are an imperative, which say do something, do something, do something, in essence, these methods, they're almost exact equivalent of command message. It's just command message expressed in different way in code. and they are actually interchangeable and they are actually connectable. However, just to make sure that you get used to the interchangeability of method call and a message, in this implementation, we'll implement commands as methods.
Okay, so in literally in the event sourcing basics example, when I'm looking at this class factory implementation one, those methods that you defined in there that you just described, those, in this example, those will represent our commands, and there are no command messages elsewhere in the sample.
No, there aren't.
Okay, got it.
However, for example, if you look at first method, you can already see how it can be translated into a command. So if we have method assign employee to a factory with one parameter employee name, it's actually equivalent to command message named assign employee to factory with one field called employee name.
Yep.
Same way transfer shipment to cargo bay, method call with two parameters, it's equal to command message, which has two fields as well.
Yeah, that makes those line up pretty well for me anyway. When I see those, I would just by the naming alone, I immediately saw the command messages in my head, you know.
They are both named the same way, imperative. Yeah. So in essence, like right now, we'll be running our factory model locally in the code. However, if we were to take this, our implementation, and host in real-world production server, actually this sounds more scary than it is, and be able to communicate with that server remotely, then we'll just send command messages, assign employee to a factory, transfer shipment to cargo bay, and this server, upon accepting these command messages, it will just wire via application service infrastructure this method calls, and it will pass fields into the parameters and invoke this, and it will invoke this method calls.
Yep.
So, but once again, method call that sounds like a command is equivalent to a command.
Got it.
Okay, so let's dive now inside the implementation of a single method call. This method call, it's in essence a behavior. A behavior can consist of following elements. First, like when we are assigning employee to factory, we can do some checks. We might need to do some checks. In our story before, as if you recall, we had check that if employee with the same name is already assigned to the factory, we can't do anything, we will fail. Or another check is if the name of employee to be assigned is Bender, then we will also fail. Failure, it is usually expressed as an exception being thrown. In our case, we will just print something to the console, although these are equivalent. One first element is check. Second element is optional. Another optional element is some work. So in essence, if we're commanding our factory, first step will be to check if the worker can be assigned to the factory. Second step will be actually paperwork, like creating a new card, filling in this card with worker information, printing out security pass for the worker, and actually letting the worker enter the factory. In this case, we're just pretending and we're just letting the current thread sleep for 1 second to make it feel as if our computer was doing some real work for us.
Mm-hmm.
And the last step is to actually record that this happened to a factory. And we record that by creating an event that describes the essential part of what happened and writing it to a journal. Okay? So in essence, inside our method that captures behavior, assign employee to a factory, we'll have three elements. First, check if employee can be assigned to a factory, then do some paperwork, and then actually record that employee was assigned to a factory.
Yeah, and that's in the factory implementation two you're referring to, where you have the check if employee can be assigned to factory. That's literally the domain business rules being implemented inside that method.
Yes. Yeah.
Okay.
Okay, and in essence, we can take almost any method on a factory implementation and describe it this way. Okay, so now that we have the idea that behavior, that a method, when it's being executed, is essentially a sequence of steps, and these steps are check, some essentially checks, guards, then some heavyweight logic, maybe some business decisions. And the last step is actual record of the stuff that happened. Now, let's dive actually deeper into the code, and that will be a factory implementation frame.
Okay.
So, in essence, in this code, that's equivalent to factory implementation too, but we just go slightly deeper. So, we start by looking inside the assign employee to a factory method. So, first, just as a highlight, just to make it the stuff more visible to the console, we actually print the command that we're actually executing. So in our case, we're just printing, okay, hey, we're assigning employee, we're trying to assign employee with this name to a factory. Then we proceed with our check. What first check is if our list of employee names contains this new name of the employee, then we will fail. And actually, if you look at the code, I just read the variables, and I actually read what happens. I actually read the code. And although this might sound, what's the word, as excessive, but that is extremely important. Our code should read like a text, Because our code represents something that can be, exist in the real world and that can be expressed as a text. So there should be always connections. The, if you have some words in your domain model, if you have some words in your ubiquitous language, then try to use them in your code as much as possible. Yes, I understand that this can make your variable names or parameter names or method names look longer. But since storage is dead cheap these days, we don't really care.
Right, and I think there's a, I mean, in the example of factory implementation 3, that's, I think you're striking a good balance. It's not too long, but it's extremely descriptive. It reads literally like a sentence. I mean, it says, if our list of employee names dot contains employee name, then, I mean, my mom can understand that.
Mm-hmm.
So
that's the idea. And in essence, by writing, writing the code in such a descriptive way, you're also bringing additional value to that code. You're ensuring that the code will be easier to maintain in the long term, that you can hire a new developer or a new junior developer, and you can bring in him in to write additional tests or maybe to write in some additional modifications. In essence, maintainable code costs a lot more than hacky code that is hard to maintain. As I say, there is like some code is write only. You'll write it once and then you can never understand. Obviously, write-only code that is can be understood only by elite hackers. It can look complicated, but it doesn't cost much. Really large enterprise companies, or maybe small startups that have to save resources, they care about the code that is both writable and readable and maintainable. That's actually is such code, as they say, is worth its value in gold. Okay, so in our implementation of method assign employee to a factory, we go through all three steps. First, we do the check by checking the variable of our list of employee names for existence of employee name. We'll get back to that variable a little bit later. Then another check, if our employee name is Bender, then once again, we fail and we return. As in essence, this first method fail that prints something to the console and then return that exits out of this method immediately, essentially breaks the execution, is equivalent to throwing an exception,
mm-hmm.
which so carries out some information and also breaks the execution. But since I didn't want to pollute this sample with try-catch statements, I just skipped it.
Yeah, and just to say that again, the when you look at the sample code, this thing that says fail with some text on it that just goes out to the console, in the real world, that's where you would implement your exceptions on, you know, something went wrong. You wouldn't just write it to the console typically.
Okay, and then after we've done some checks, we pretend that we're doing some paperwork to factory. In the real world implementation, these can be calls, for example, to domain services. That integrate with third-party systems like worker management system or employee, I don't know, recording system or automation that opens factory doors. And then we actually record that into a journal, the fact that new employee was assigned to a factory. And the thing that we record is our event. As we talked earlier, events, they are spoken in a past tense and they explain something that happened in the past. So here's what we do. Okay, and if we go into the contents of the record that method, it's actually contains three code statements. Code statement is actually add this event to a journal of factory events. So as we were saying earlier, event sourcing is a way of persisting something as a sequence of events. Within this episode and within this code sample, we focus only on one day on a factory. So we don't care too much about the persistence, but still it is there and it will be used at the end of the sample. Second statement is a dynamic redirect call, which says announce inside a factory. So obviously in order to do stuff inside the factory, you need to have some lists or reports or something inside the factory. Workers have to know what's actually happening around them. They have to understand, they have to keep track of what the heck is going on. And so this announce inside the factory, it's actually wires, passes the event to any specific method call that is interested in this event inside the factory and updates some variables. Event sourcing magic kicks in.
Well, so in that record that, I see that it's, you know, you're passing in an I event of E, and the first line is journal of factory events dot add, and then that event E. So I'm assuming, and I actually never connected these two for whatever reason, but in event sourcing, the event store, it only stores events. It never stores the commands?
Well, you, in essence, event store, just to be exactly precise, is something that can store objects. So you can store commands and events. Oh. Although commands are irrelevant for our persistence, but they're good for audit logs. Technically, event store can store commands as well. However, like from the domain modeling perspective, we don't care about the commands. We don't store them.
I see. So in this sample, we are, in fact, only storing the events in the event store because that's going to keep track of the state of our model, and you would optionally persist your commands for the audit purposes of what happened, what caused these events.
However, like in this sample, we don't even actually have event store yet. So this journal of factory events is just an in-memory list of stuff that happened today.
Okay.
When the day ends and we want to save everything that happened in the factory during the day, we'll take this journal of factory events and we'll persist it to some harder media.
I see.
But so far, we assume that something that happens within a day is something that we can keep fresh in our memory, and it just happens like this.
Mm-hmm.
Immediately and absolutely in an absolutely consistent way. So record that method. Like the first two statements are important. First statement, it records event that happened in this factory within this day, in short journal. And second, it passes this event to method that will be used to update state of the factory, some additional variables inside the factory.
This is really in the implementation details, but I've seen you use this approach a couple of times, and it looks like magic to me. Can you explain a little bit about right under that entry of journal of factory events dot add, there's this call to announce this event as happening to the factory, and you're using dynamic and this and some syntax I'm not that familiar with. Can you explain in English what's going on there?
Okay. First, from the factory perspective, so in essence, what we're doing here, it's there is a guy that records something in the journal, that was journal of factory events, and he also shouts to everybody in the factory, hey guys, that's what happened. And this shouting part, it is this dynamic sentence. In essence, it's just a shortcut that tells the compiler and the execution runtime to take this event and pass it to any method inside this factory class that has the name announce inside factory and has a parameter that matches to the type of event.
Oh, that's cool. So that line using that trick is how that method below this one gets this event.
Yes. So in essence, this is a replacement of a large if-then statement. Mm-hmm. So for example, if I were to write, if the event is employee assigned to a factory, then call the method it's announced inside the factory with this event. Or if the event is shipment transferred to a cargo bay, then call another method.
I see.
So in essence, this is just a shortcut.
Right.
But magically pass the specific event directly to the method that can handle it.
And because of that shortcut, if as you add more things that care about this specific event, you know, you've got today in this sample, you've got an announce inside factory, but if there was 20 other methods that cared about this event, you could use that shortcut just right below it, you know, and anything named this, you can send it to that. Anything named this, send it to that, basically.
Yes.
Oh, that's awesome. Okay, cool.
Okay. So in essence, once again, our record that method, it does two things. First, we write something down to the journal of the factory, and then we shout it to immediately shout as we write that, shout that to everybody inside the factory. Hey, that's what this happened. And like there are people, they say, oh, okay, so there was this new guy coming to the factory, so our list of employee names now contains this name. And then the guy who is actually responsible for accepting new employees, he will remember that. And he'll be able to check, hey, you are like this guy was already on our factory. You can't come in.
Oh, so yeah, I actually didn't connect that. Like I thought you needed distinct methods for multiple things to happen to that event. But no, you actually are using this one single event that happened. And even inside right below it, announcements inside the factory, you're able to do, you know, you update the list, you update the shipments and all this stuff, all based on one event happening.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah, cool. Okay.
Well, so in essence, like the variables, our list of employee names and variable shipment waiting to be unloaded, it's how workers inside the factory perceive their current state. It's their representation of the current state. It's their understanding. So obviously, like the operation is carried by one worker inside the factory, but since we consider this factory to be one and a whole, when something happens with one worker, it clicks immediately in the minds of other workers, and they update their in-memory picture. So these variables, our list of employee names and shipments waiting to be unloaded, it's our in-memory representation of factory state. It's our current memory representation of factory state, and it's updated immediately as something happens to the factory.
Got it.
I understand that my explanation of this part can be quite confusing and not clear, and this is just an indication that I myself don't fully understand like how to explain this in simple words, which means that I don't really understand it, the event sourcing myself.
No, I mean, I understand what the sample is doing now. I just that dynamic stuff and this dot the syntax just confused me a little bit. But now that I look right below it in the sample and see the benefits of that, you're able to use one method signature of announce inside factory that takes some kind of strongly typed object of an event and let the compiler deal with all those strongly typed event types in one simple way. So mm-hmm. So that's cool.
Yes, and so in essence, our factory as an object, it has methods. This once again, these methods can contain complex behaviors. While invoking and doing something with these complex behaviors, first we have to make these decisions. And we make decisions based on our understanding of what is current factory state. We don't change this current factory state. We just see it and we make the decisions. And we express the decisions that they were made by recording them into our journal. The decision is considered to be made only after we recorded that. And our code is implemented in such a way that immediately when we record that event into this journal, not only the event is added to the list, but it's also is announced all across the factory. And since we have this smart and crazy dynamic code, this announcement means that everybody who is interested in that event will immediately update the state variables.
Yep.
Which means that, for example, inside the assign employee to a factory, at the point when when we're trying to assign our first employee, for example, and when there are no employees, so our list of employee names will be empty. However, as soon as method call record that new employee assigned to factory with employee name, let's say Luke, as soon as this method is executed, then at the end of the execution of this method, our list of employee names will contain Luke. This is because the event first was recorded to the log, and then it was shouted out to the factory. And as part of the factory announcement, one of the effects was that our list of employee names was updated. This is extremely powerful aspect of event sourcing, which we'll exploit heavily later when we'll be evolving our models to get more complex and intricate behaviors. One rule and one takeaway right now is that we might have some state variables inside our aggregate, inside our factory object. However, we don't change them. For instance, we could have added our employee name directly to our list of employee names. However, this is prohibited. You just can't do that. Yes, well, of course, you can do that in the code, but you shouldn't do that. We change these variables via a long way. We publish an event that says that something happened. And as a side effect of that event being published, the list will be updated.
That makes sense. Yeah, so the state of all these things, in this case, our list of employee names, we didn't call that list directly and say, you know, put the word Bender and Luke in there. We let the side effect of publishing the event and those things that care about the event take care of that.
Yes. We will make this concept more explicit in the next episode. But for now, the important aspect of this decision that will change our state variables only via the events, in essence, it guarantees that all important changes are persisted in the events, because otherwise we will not be able to make further decisions on, based on the information that they contain. In essence, this ensures us, first, that all our changes are used in the events and they can be used, for example, in the reports downstream. And second, it ensures that we have perfect audit log that of what happened in the system. If you are dealing with so-called enterprise systems, one of the really complicated and rather frequently used requirement is that some systems require for compliance to have full audit log of everything that happened. And in a classical approach, you will have some code that, for example, changes something in the database, and that then prints something to the additional audit log table. However, with this approach, one of the common problems is that, okay, somebody refactored this database changing call, and they save additional information, but they forgot to update this auditing method. Mm-hmm. And so it's not complete. Here, since we're persisting our changes via the events, and we know for sure that everything is persisted in that event, because if it is not persisted, then we can't use that information in subsequent method calls. This guarantees us that the information in the event stream is perfect audit log.
Right, because nowhere in our system is state allowed to change without an event being written to the journal or the event stream first.
Yes. The only way to change state of an aggregate, the state of the factory, is by publishing an event. And a side effect of recording, publishing or recording that event is that the state will change.
Got it.
Okay, and so in this sample, there are additional implementation of assign employee to a factory, transfer shipment to cargo bay, and I'll finish unload shipment from cargo bay and produce car. In essence, the idea is that these things should be read as a sentence. Not as a sentence, as a text. Even better. I will keep in the final sample that will be published within this episode, there will be only two methods implemented. And for two additional methods, produce car and unload shipment from cargo bay, it will be for the homework.
Okay.
Okay, and for the record, for example, the homework, it will be to implement the story like this. We can unload shipment from the cargo bay only if the employee hasn't been doing any unloading today and if there are actually any shipments at this cargo bay. And when we unload shipments from cargo bay, actually all shipments that are already stored in the cargo bay, they are unloaded. And this means that they are available on the factory for thorough production. And then we can have somebody produce cars. And we know that car Model T, if we want to produce it, it requires 6 wheels, 1 engine, and 2 sets of bits and pieces. And that's the only car that we can produce. And if we have enough spare parts inside our factory, and if we have employee that has, if our employee that we're asking has been doing any car production within that day, then we'll be able to produce that car successfully. Otherwise, we got we'll fail. Okay, so that will be the part of the future homework. Back to our sample. So later in that sample, I wrote actually code that takes that creates an instance of factory implementation, and that actually tries to execute some behaviors.
And where's that? Where are you looking at right now, Rina?
Scroll down to after the third implementation, mm-hmm. There are methods, and then there is a method run factory implementation three, which I'll probably merge into the main.
Oh, I see. Main. Okay, got it. Run factory implementation three. Got it.
Okay, so in essence, here we're writing our commands expressed as methods in this case. So we're telling the factory, please transfer shipment to cargo bay. And this shipment is named chassis, and it contains 4 chassis. And based on the discussion before, we know that if we have a fresh factory and there are no workers in it, that method should fail. And if you launch the console, it will actually say that. So in essence, we have our model first expressed in the text, then we have the same model expressed in the code, and then when we're running this model in a console, it will tell exactly the same story in different words. So if you set this project in Visual Studio as startup and hit Control F5, you should read this story.
Yep, and I see that in the console outputting the story.
Yes. So, for example, first lines say we have a command, colored blue, transfer shipment to cargo bay. And then there is a failure according to our script, according to our plan, that there has to be somebody at factory in order to accept shipment. And just for the reference, the code color that I'm using both in my blog and in diagrams and in different tools that aid development is that commands are blue. They're blue because they're unsure, because you're never sure if it will be executed as expected. Events are green. There's something that has happened, it is okay, and something that has happened, it can never be changed. Well, obviously, failures are colored red, and some actual work or state persistence, it's usually colored yellow.
I see.
Okay, and so in our code, we play with the factory. It's in essence as if we were telling our granny that was telling our story, and we try to ask stupid questions like, what would happen if Red Hood didn't go into the forest? Or what would happen if Red Hood, instead of the, pies, took a shotgun and a set of grenades? And since we have the story expressed already, so the factory implementation class should provide coherent accents, should provide coherent reactions and answers to the command that we're trying to throw at this factory. So, for example, if we have if we assign Yoda to a factory, then second attempt to assign Yoda to a factory fails shoot because only one Yoda can there be. Okay? And just to demonstrate one of the side effects of the event sourcing, as applied to this really simple sample is that after running this, after trying to run certain commands with the factory, which are transfer shipments and assign employees, and seeing what happens as a side effect to that, we also ask our factory to print what happened today. And that's at the end of this method, large method call, we're just enumerate through the journal of factory events and print these events to the factory. And once again, it will print the same events that happened. So in essence, we're here, we're printing our audit log. And it's also the same set of events that later on will be persisting to our event store.
Right, and at the bottom where you're printing out those events, I see they're all green because anything that wasn't green didn't happen, basically.
Yes, yes, yes.
Got it. Well, would we persist those failures, or would we want to know about, you know, the so, you know, in this example, you have, you assign Yoda to the factory, and then you try to assign another Yoda to the factory, and I see in the console in red, you know, the name of Yoda already exists, basically. It's an error. That's where an exception would happen, and the events, the state doesn't care about that. The audit log may care about it, and the exception handling may care about it, but our event, the place we store our truth, the state doesn't care.
Yes, in this case, we don't care, because in this universe, we technically don't even think that they can be two Yodas.
Got it. Yeah. So, well, everybody knows or not, there can never be two Yodas, but yes, I understand that for the sake of simplicity, you know, in another implementation, we may actually care about that, but in this example, we don't. We throw it away. We throw an error, we print it red, and at the end, when you're printing out the events that we care about, those things aren't in there.
Yes. Well, actually, the universe in which two Yodas might exist is when we bring Avengers and Star Wars into the same universe, and they have already suspected, like when Yoda was young, he was much bigger and bumpier and without hair, and he was called Hulk.
Oh, I'm smelling way too geeky here. I wonder how many listeners we just lost. Well, maybe that's a good thing. Maybe we're adding listeners. We're going to get a bunch of Comic-Con fans or something listening on. So, anyway.
Since back to the topic of failures. So the failures, in essence, we're handling it is based on case-by-case basis. Some failures were just having sanity checks because something is not allowed to happen, and normally it does not happen. For example, that manager always knows that there can be no second Yoda or second employee with the same name is sent to the factory, and if this, like, if command comes in, it's because of some typo or new manager was assigned who doesn't know what the heck is going on. So we just throw an exception, and somebody at the maintenance will handle this exception.
Mm-hmm.
Also, it may our system might be configured in such a way that when actually our factory throws an exception, it will be intercepted at a higher level, and it will be packed into a maybe some side event that will also be persisted into the event store, but only even in the case if this is relevant to us.
Okay.
So there are multiple ways of handling this. Or one more way is that we might be actually willing to have our factory not inside something that picks up the commands from the queue, but inside a remote procedure callable interface. And in this case, when we're calling a remote factory and asking it to assign an employee to a factory, if this method calls fails, then we'll, as a response, we'll get an exception. So multiple scenarios are possible. How would you deal with failures? Their implementation, their handling depends on case-by-case basis. Personally, in production, when I'm working on a domain model, if I know that something normally should never happen unless if I get something or something changes in an expected way, so I code in these assumptions as throw exception. And the infrastructure is structured in such a way that if an exception is thrown, then it will be recorded along with the command message that caused it. And then we'll probably discuss it later when we get to the Locate Security infrastructure. So this information is persisted on a disk, and it is also mailed to our customer support. Customer support and system support, usually that's just me. And when I get this failure, I can always reproduce it locally. That's one of the positive side effects. Because I know the time of the day, exact time at which this failure happened, I will also persist like which version of the factory we're using. I can actually load this factory locally from the production event store. And by replaying the events inside the factory, I will be able to reproduce the exact state of the factory at the moment when this exception occurred. Then I can fire that instance like in a local unit test. I can pass in the command because it's also being persisted. And I will have in my debugger the exact state of the factory at the moment of exception. I'll be able to investigate what was the problem. I will be able to fix the error. However, there is even more fun in that. After the code is fixed, we can push it into the production, take our command message that was failed and that was recorded, and send it to the factory once again. And this time, this command will pass.
And, that's an example kind of where you're striking the balance between, I don't these should be anomalies and I don't care about it, so I can throw an exception, but I have a convenient way to package those exceptions so I can at least evaluate it after the fact and decide if I care about it now or don't, or just fix the problem and move on.
Yes. So in essence, by saying that we'll handle these exceptions later when they happen, or we'll handle these exceptions later if they happen, we'll just save us some work.
Mm-hmm.
We still don't discard any information that will prevent us from handling this exception later. Because we're using event sourcing and because we'll be able to get factory back to the exact state when this exception happened. And actually, like just a story from LOCAD, we're working with some relatively slow processes. And like, as you probably know, big data number crunching can take hours to compute.
Mm-hmm.
So if we have some long-running process and there is a command that comes in, and for example, this command points to customer data that contains some failing symbols, like some illegal input. Maybe it contains some ASCII control characters, which we normally can't process, and our Excel generation fails. However, since I can reproduce that information, I can always debug this, I can find the problem, and maybe I can just add a quick fix that will correct customers' data and will be able to produce a report, even though normally would never be able to handle this. And after the deploying a fix, I can resend the command and have a customer's business process going on to a successful finish. Repeating multiple times, and in essence, we're able to fix issues in our models even before like they were actually noticed. Not maybe fixing issues or maybe proactively adding features, maybe adding some helpful information, et cetera, et cetera.
Right. So it's allowing you to take those exceptions and the data that goes along with those to potentially fix problems before the customers even realize there was one.
Yes. And it also has one more important side effect, is that by delaying decisions, you're actually bringing a lot of value. Because by delaying decisions that may be not important, instead you can focus on something that is extremely more important right now. And this speeds up the process of delivery of core value to the market, of core value to the software. This actually allows you to actually start making money instead of wasting time on handling this exception, handling this exception, handling this exception.
Mm-hmm.
Of course, having that said, it's really important to balance out the exceptions that are important, that are very valuable, that are risky enough, and the exceptions that don't really matter. And if they happen, we don't care that much, or we can fix that easier.
Makes sense.
Okay, and these are additional like production level benefits that you can gain from using event sourcing and secure as best implementations.
Cool. I I want to get in there and mess with that sample and work on the homework because I think it's going to solidify my brain even more after I start messing around with it. And I was about to just switch over to Trello because I'm not actually sure what the next episode is about. Do you happen to know? What are we talking about next time?
Say we'll go deeper into the event sourcing.
Okay. All right.
So probably we'll take and discuss one additional side effect of event sourcing. It's testing the event sourcing. And actually express your code in a text by one additional way while testing it and printing human-readable specifications that can be passed down to the quality assurance, and that will explain exactly what code says.
Cool. And I think that, you know, so we're not 100% sure exactly what we're going to be talking about, but that means write in your comments and go to the Trello board and give us feedback because you could influence the next episode a little bit. So
back to the actual feedback loop. So in essence, if you have folks, if you have any questions, if some of the my explanations were not just confusing but outstandingly confusing, once again, don't hesitate to add comments, and then Carrie will voice them in the next episode.
Sounds good. And I think that'll do it for this one. We ran pretty long on this one. So I think mental note to me is if I can get Renat to record in the evenings, the episodes might run longer. That may be good or bad. I don't know if I know I enjoyed it. So hopefully this extended episode will be good for you guys too. But until then, we're at beingtheworst.com. We're on Twitter at beingtheworst, and on GitHub, beingtheworst is our username. Check out the source code. Give us the feedback. We're getting more and more feedback. Really appreciate it. So keep it coming. And Renat, do you have anything else?
Yeah, sure. Next time we'll try to time box back to the 20, 25 minutes.
Oh, wow. He's already trying to get out of it. I was already pushing for more. I'm just like a customer. You know, you give them an inch, they want to take a mile. You know, you time box of 20 and 30 minutes. I'm like, all right, hour episodes. Here we go. But anyway, we'll fight offline on that one. And we'll see you guys next time on the Being the Worst podcast. Take care. Bye-bye.
Thanks, guys. Bye.
Bye.